I had to watch Jake Albaugh code all day, and it just ruined my afternoon. The guy writing Tone.js on his YouTubes fluently just ruined my day. Hey there, Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, now 300 years old. We're the Shop Talk Show, 301 years old. It's not years, is it, Chris?
301. It's weeks, though, which is a whole bunch of weeks, really.
Yeah.
Count a couple of, you know, on-purpose missed weeks in there for holidays and whatnot, and we're over 6 years, which is cool. You got to drink in the last episode, so I'm drinking in this one, I decided.
Yep, I'm absolutely buzzing with the anticipation for what kind of questions we have here on the show.
Yeah, let's do a rapid fire. We've had guest, then special show 300, and we haven't done a lot of meat and potatoes stuff. Let's do meat and potatoes stuff.
Let's get in it. Rachel Abrams writes in, congratulations on your 300th show. Thank you, Rachel. You're the winner for saying that. You get 10 Shop Talk points, which you can use as credit at this now defunct Shop Talk store. I'm struggling in deciding to use Vue/React versus server-generated JavaScript partials/intercooler. Intercooler is not something I'm familiar with. She explains it for us. Intercooler is a library that makes using AJAX the responsibility of the server side. It does this by focusing on receiving and displaying HTML partials instead of JSON. Server-generated HTML seems to get the job done. But I feel like I'm missing out on the latest and greatest.
Intercooler.
Pull up the old Googler. Intercooler.js.
It seemed to me that what's in the water at the moment is that it would be awful nice if the JavaScript stack would, when it's run on the server side, it's responsible for generating the HTML and blasting it down and whatever. And so if you have a server side router, you know, it's part of the fast boot mentality, you know, like a URL, even if JavaScript doesn't load, the server should be able to interpret that URL, interpret what you want, and get you some HTML that will render that page, whether or not there's JavaScript on the client. That's so cool. And probably is in place on about 1% of JavaScript rendered apps, but it's possible and there's movement towards that. And the reason it's cool is, you know, speed is one of the reasons. People worry about SEO is one of the reasons, whether it's valid or not, I don't know. But it seems to be a worthy goal to me that server-side generated apps are cool and doesn't mean that you necessarily need to give up on, you know, single page app, Ajaxy fancy new stuff. And it sounds like maybe Intercooler is a tool to help with that in a way. It's fascinating to me to watch this happen over time. You know, like let's say you want to make your WordPress site a single page app. I think that would be cool. I'd love to do that. I'd love to try it. I'm not ready to give up on my server side generated version of my site, but if I could somehow turn it into an SBA, that'd be cool. Watching this evolve, it was, you know, there was a new library from the Basecamp people. Did you see that one? Static?
Yeah. I was actually pulling it up to try to figure out what the actual name was. So, but yeah, there's some other things kind of in this thing. It that you write HTML, you go to the server, and then the server says, cool, I got HTML back for you because that's what I do. I'm an HTML machine.
Yeah.
And then you use some JavaScript to either find and replace, or DOM diff would be a cool, like DOM change list or something. But that doesn't exist. But like you basically diff, you basically say like, okay, what do I have and what needs to change? And then
nice, which is at least it's doing that intelligently, because I think that new Basecamp library says, well, if you want this to work in an SPA world, that's great. You should use TurboLinks for that. And I think the guts of TurboLinks is you're totally in charge of server-side rendering on yourself. Any link that you click, we're going to intercept. I'm going to make a server-side AJAX request for the whole document of whatever that URL returns. I'm going to diff the head, and I'm just going to plop out the entire body of the entire HTML document. And what's cool about that is, like, it just works. You don't need any help to do that. You have a server-side rendered app already. You just lose some efficiency. You're not getting that virtual DOM diffing thing where, well, really the difference between this page and this page was just this little div over here, so that's all we're going to update. Instead, you have to update the entire body, which probably isn't quite as performant. But hey, you got a single-page app out of it. It's probably at least feels a little bit nicer than that full hefty reload.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably on this side of things, to be like, having experimented with like some, you know, React apps, Preact and all this stuff. I like it. It's fine. It just, you're doing a lot on the front end, you know, and I just feel like I kind of want to, I like writing the server hardware, you know, or the server software. And I like that it just returns HTML. Like it just spits out HTML. It seems like very bulletproof, and these like apps like libraries like Intercooler here, and TurboLinx, and then Stimulus, which is the new kind of TurboLinx plus thing, is from the Basecamp people, Signal versus Noise blog. This stuff is interesting to me just because I have like a Rails app, Daytrip, you know, and you know, and I would like a little bit of je ne sais quoi, you know, I'd like a little bit of that going on, you know, without coding it in jQuery, which is kind of what I'm doing, and it's a little bit of a joke, you know, it's like I like jQuery and then I slide a thing and then I like disappear a thing and then I remove it and then I have to fire off the request to actually remove it. You know, I would like it to be kind of more modular, you know.
Yeah. And so this looks like a library to augment existing HTML with Ajax requests and stuff. So you're right that to compare this to Stimulus and TurboLinx, I think. And maybe the world will be going that way. I just can't abide by writing two apps, you know, like that was what you'd have to do if you wanted a fully viewified WordPress API driven website, and you didn't want to compromise one bit on your existing server side rendered WordPress app. You'd be writing it twice, or you'd be some exotic middleman thing for server side rendering your the view portion of it, which I'm not sure what the story is there, but you just don't see that, you know, it's not a popular thing to do. If some people are doing it, fine, but it's definitely not just the way to develop, you know, and nobody's going to write their app twice. You know, I shouldn't say that because before the RWD days, we were totally making M dots and stuff. So maybe they're.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, AMP is like writing your app twice,
but
I think writing twice is like a, not just a, it's a code smell. And I think the thing with any of these, like you just add some data attributes and it works with your backend, bingo, bingo. For me, like if I have to write specific data attributes to achieve an effect, you know, I'm now kind of hard coding my HTML to
your framework,
to my framework or some sort of architecture.
Even that you don't like.
Well, I think I've just lived long enough. I know that comes back to haunt you. You know what I mean? Like, how many times have you, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to not use jQuery anymore? And then you like open up your JavaScript folder and you're like, we got a lot of work to do. This is 2 months of unwriting jQuery, you know, that's just an example. But like, imagine if you did that, like where like jQuery intercepted every link, you know, based on like some data attribute or something, which, you know, I've actually seen in the wild. So like, you know, you can like that, you know, you have to undo this, you know, and now you're not just modifying some JavaScript and you're not just modifying some server code. You have to like modify every piece of HTML in the whole site, you know, and just hope it kind of doesn't break and all that. So, all that to say, I like these and I want to use them, but I also am like, I the like hard codiness of it is worrisome to me maybe. So, that's me.
So you'd move the data attribute to JavaScript.
Well, this is, I can talk myself into JavaScript, I think is what I'm doing here. It just that, like, you know, if you write it in JavaScript, everything's there. And now you're just modifying JavaScript.
Right, especially, you know, if the theory of this front-end library is, don't worry, this totally works with your totally existing back-end technology. It seems like it would, but it doesn't. You have to sprinkle this into your HTML. Like, maybe it'd be easier if it wasn't HTML to begin with. I don't know. Then it's jQuery. Tough.
Yeah, I almost wish there's like a... I mean, the big thing is like forms or something, right? Like fetching, you know, like in showing a thank you, success or error message or whatever based on that. Like, I think there's, I wish there was like a form fetch or something, like and if you had like the fetch attribute instead of like a get or a post or whatever, it was like fetch and it would fetch it and come back and like, and if it, like in a smartly detect if there's HTML in the response, I'm just going to put that HTML in there and announce it to Aria that I have a success message. Wouldn't that be cool?
That's insane. I've never even thought of that. Like a, you know, you think of it on a form element because of the action attribute and the type is get post, whatever. The exact opposite of pushing data somewhere is asking to please get some data in HTML. That would be wild.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think there's a few, but maybe that doesn't work if, you know, you Google search and it has to like render in a different thing, you know. But I just wish there was like a mechanic like that or something like a favorite, you know. It's kind of like, you know, if you click the heart, you could almost program like a, like on success, you know, do like, success, turn it red, you know, it's like fail, you know, like, you know, pop error or something like that. Like, so each like a ref or whatever could also have like success attribute and fail attribute, like almost like a fetch success and fail. Like you basically, I don't know, you just say what happens if this
reminds you. I remember early WooFoo days, or, you know, for the most part, we'd like, just don't even want to deal with like attaching handlers to things. So we're just going to use inline JavaScript for most stuff. Even if it if it comes in via Ajax in some way, whatever, it's got click handlers and all the handlers are already in inline attributes on all the HTML. That was like the mantra, like, please do it this way because it's just makes sense. You know, it's a button. It's going to do one thing. The handler's already attached to it, already in the HTML. It's already ready to go.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's, it was definitely a time where that was highly shamed.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
No. And I mean, I think it's all come back. I mean, you know, if you write React or whatever, it's, you've got like on click, on, you know, change, on submit. Those are your three methods. Exactly. And you just kind of write those over and over and over.
And how it hits the browser is different, but still. Anyway, that's a lot of stuff. We got a one here from somebody named Anon, which is just an incredible name, you know, to have your first name and last name be the same and anonymous. Anyway, they're on a team of three developers working on three different coding projects. Of the three projects, we're assigned a project for ourselves with no other help from the two developers. So everybody's on, you know, at least two. So ultimately making each web developer having his or her own project. On this team, we all feel as if we would get much more accomplished if the three of us were tag teaming the three projects, which each of us bring our creative mindsets to ensure this app is doing the same thing it should instead of having one superhero. All projects have the same priority. Our upper management won't budge. What's your thoughts on this? Fascinating.
Have you tried a chat room? Have you tried a Slack chat of some kind?
No, I feel this very directly right now in that I agree with you. I hate to, you know, take sides without knowing all the people involved and all the details of it, but I think that human beings work better together when you can all weigh in and think about what's going on together and apply your shared connected knowledge. You're bigger as a whole than the sum of your parts to each individual project and maybe like having mini sprints across them. As a matter of fact, it's kind of coming to a head at CodePen that we're going to be at least trying that more instead of like, let's split up into tiny micro teams and have this and have the micro teams, you know, catch up on Monday, but for the most part are totally independent of each other. That was a fun experiment, but we're coming to learn that no, we're too small of a team to have that be effective, and that moving together on one thing as a whole team is something at least we'd like to try. And because our hypothesis is strongly that we're going to be better and release better code and faster and less sloppy and more tested and all that if we're all moving together rather than siloed. So I do feel strongly about it at the moment. We'll see how it goes. But
yeah, I mean, I would almost, if you're a team of three, I mean, I think you need, I would kind of like set up some pair programming where at least some point in the week, whether it's a afternoon or something, you're kind of sharing knowledge, because what happens is you three working independently are going to make three different apps that then all have to kind of work together. And then, you know, somebody's going to quit because they're mad, but or they get a better job offer. And then you're going to have to onboard somebody onto project number three, and you don't know how it works, and they don't, you know, and, right. And then the new person has to show up, and whatever person three wrote, you have no idea. And so you can't even train them. And so it's actually if you can share that knowledge among your team and do code reviews and do whatever, like, it's going to go so much better for your company. It's an investment in your company, which that maybe is how you have to like pitch it to management, is like we have a bus number of one. If we a bus number is kind of a developer or whatever startup-y term, but like if the bus crashes and somebody passes away, like what happens, you know? But and if each developer is assigned to three projects, you have a bus number of one three times, you know, like, so you need to fix that. That you need to solve that.
I think that's a very good point. Even just that, all that stuff just augments my concept of that you're just not as powerful individually, that having multiple brains looking at a thing is going to be like, oh, you coded this part of the app up some, oh, it's a commenting system. And oh, how'd you do that? Well, you should have definitely used PubNub for that. That's, you know, it's cheap and it does just what you need. And you spent way too much time thinking that out without talking to me, who I just coded that last week for a thing. And I have a solution I feel like is more elegant than yours. Not that it's a competition. It's just that you've used shared brain power, you know? And that's just what I've found, is that a siloed developer is going to, sometimes they just talk themselves into crazy town and do way more work than they needed to, as compared to if everybody talks about it individually. You're like, no, I'll handle that part. I'm telling you, I got that, but I like your idea here. That's really smart. I'll take that to something else I'm working on. You're better talking on the same thing, for sure.
I work with this guy, Julian. We brought some friends in to help us with the project. I work pretty close with this guy named Julian Jones. And Julian and I are very similar in what we do, except he's like a legit like medical doctor, has like a PhD. He's like a legit doctor. But he also like has more of a Java background, and he used to program satellites. So, you know, we're basically the same. But you know, in he's kind of exposing me. He likes Angular, and he's exposing me to Angular in this project. And it's like, I kind of like Angular. It wouldn't have been like my first or second or third pick probably, but it's like, I kind of really like it. Yeah. And like, because it's just, I don't know, it's just very well set up, but
using the like I'm CLI to, like, style, like folders of components thing.
Yeah, this Angular 5 CLI, 4 5 CLI is beautiful, and so it's really nice. But I've been exposed to this, and you know, things to me that are hard, it's like, oh, I don't, this auth system or whatever, how are we going to do it? He's just like, oh, I did it. Here's the code for it. And it's like, oh, okay, that's done. But the inverse is, you know, he's like, hey, Dave, have you ever seen like this weird bug in IE10, and because I'm dumb, I have, and like it's like, oh yes, that's because IE10 doesn't have flex basis, so we need to figure that out. And so like it's just kind of dumb stuff, you know, like you share that knowledge, and like you're, again, it's like if you're working by yourself, you're just trying to solve every problem by yourself. When if you work with even two people, somebody, you're like surface area to have encountered a problem before is so much greater, that somebody, you know, it's that thing. It's like, I see like auth systems as difficult, and, like I get laden by that, you know, like it's a heavy thing to code out, but to somebody else, it's like, oh, I'll just do it. So, you know, it's that, like, you need to bring those in, or else everybody's going to be stressed out. And there may be like some context switching, so you want to kind of fence guard around that. Like three of you coding three apps, all three together simultaneously, is probably too much. But you know, it's like you kind of maybe set up a primary developer and a code reviewer, you know, or like a floater assistant, you know, or like, can you spot me on Wednesday afternoon on this? It's like, yeah, I can, you know, I think that's going to add so much value to your company. And I don't think you'll slip timelines at all. If anything, I could almost guarantee, don't send me an invoice, but I can almost guarantee you'll like, it'll be easier because like the other person will have the answer instantly, or, you know, so you should definitely do that. GitHub, I think, pair programs a lot, and they're a successful company. So I think there can only be wins, is kind of my point of view.
I just love it. I think it's so awesome, pair programming. Just seeing how somebody else's brain works, it's just incredible.
It's almost like how it's meant to be, right? Like
I've never heard somebody's like, oh, we pair program at my company and it's awful. I think it really hurts productivity. Find somebody that tells you that.
It's like, I had to watch Jake Albaugh code all day and it just ruined my afternoon. Just the guy writing Tone.js on his YouTubes just fluently just ruined my day. When I was in Japan, when I was teaching in Japan, you know, all the kids would be taking a test, you know, and I'd be walking around and then I'd like catch two kids, like kind of like talking to each other. You're like, basically like, hey, what's number one? You know? And I would just stand next to him and like point my like fingers at the kid who's cheating, you know? And I just was like, anyone want to deal with this? Anyone want to deal with this kid's cheating? But like their mindset was like, well, if it's like a, like we have different expectations for the kids basically, but like their mindset in Japan was maybe more like communal. Like we get through this topic together. Like we get, like in your life, you're never going to be isolated, or very rarely are you just like, good luck, here are some wolves and a knife, figure it out. You know, like it's you are always kind of in a buddy system, or have peers, and their education system, or at least the teachers at my school, were very comfortable like letting kids figure it out with other people. And eventually you do have to take a test in Japan that's like all by yourself and no cheating. But like,
I like this a lot.
If it gets you from like a zero to a one, like maybe it's fine, you know, like maybe if it just gets you one step further, like you can work with people. But American education system, at least in my opinion, is very individual driven, you know, like we're set up like you're competing GPAs, you know, like it's very like do it yourself or you're a failure, you know? And so like, I think that's ridiculous. I think it should be this more communal kind of way of building software.
That you're so, especially. No, it's so rare to be working totally alone, and that it's probably doesn't help anybody. So you might as well train people like that to begin with. That's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
I was on some long flights and I was playing one of the like in-flight games, which was like world knowledge or something about the questions about the culture and customs of different countries, of course, which I scored like a zero out of a million on them. Just, it was very humbling and embarrassing what I don't know about how to behave in other countries. But one of them was interesting about like a Middle Eastern company that's like, let's say you get on a bus in Iran or something. And like somebody, like the person that gets on the bus, is will just sit down right next to you on an empty bus. And it was like, why is that? And it was the questions or whatever. And it was just like, being alone is just not, it's awkward in their culture or something. They did it, they probably did it unconsciously because nobody's ever alone kind of thing was the answer. And I'm sorry if I butchered that or it's incorrect knowledge or whatever. It was just based on an in-flight thing. But I found it interesting because no way would that happen in America. You get on an empty bus with and there's a stranger sitting there. You probably will position yourself like algorithmically as far away from them as you possibly
can. Yeah, if somebody sat next to me, that would be an invitation to fight, possibly. Yeah. Like that was an offensive bus. Yeah. That was an offensive move, and you have chosen fisticuffs as a weapon of choice. Oh, yeah, it's wild. I mean, you know, there's a lot of Asian countries. This is just my experiences traveling around. Like, there's a lot of rules about feet and shoes and, you know, like inappropriateness and stuff like that. So different customs. That's just kind of customs. But yeah, it's like back to programming, I guess, is like the culture, you know. It's like I think we have a lot of culture of like do it yourself, you know, even like the, like American dream is like you get big doing it yourself and going out on your own, Mr. Entrepreneur, man. So like, I think it's all about doing things together, especially with code and, you know, especially with this whole kind of my everything right now, just the like privacy and AI and all this stuff. Like I that needs to be like a peer reviewed situation, you know? And even there, you gotta be careful. Like you can like, two people, especially two people who look and share the same gender, can come up with very bad ideas together. So, like, you need some peer review there. That's my opinion.
Good message.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by CodePen. Lots of interesting stuff happening at CodePen, of course. It's been a while since we've talked about all that. One of them is, you know, we still have pro plans. You can still sign up for a paid account on CodePen, which opens up all kinds of possibilities of things you can do on CodePen that you can't with a free account, like, you know, drag and drop to upload assets if you need like image hosting or a place to chuck your CSS and JavaScript or whatever kind of files. And that works in CodePen projects as well, you know, which is kind of more of a full-blown IDE kind of thing where you have a sidebar of files. So if you haven't checked that out, it's a little different than pens on CodePen in that you have a whole file system to work with, which is a little bit more appealing if you're building something a little bit more complex. We just finished a rewrite of a lot of the real-time stuff on CodePen. So, for example, features that you get with CodePen Pro like collab mode and professor mode, which allow you to, like, for example, collab mode is like, I make a room and then I send it to my friend. They don't even have to have a CodePen account. And we're real-time coding together, so you can see each other's cursors, see each other's, you know, settings, changes, and of course the code that they write and the preview is all updating in real-time. So it's pair programming, but within CodePen, all you gotta do is send somebody a URL. Very similar to professor mode, but professor mode is designed to be one way. There's one teacher, and they see absolutely everything you do within it. And they both have chat rooms, you know, but professor mode, you can send to, you know, hundreds of people if you want to, and they can all watch you program in real time. Very cool. And it was a rewrite internally to just be way faster and way more kind of just reliable, to be perfectly honest with you. And it turns out, like, if you're interested in how it works, is we ended up moving to Firebase, the Google kind of real-time DB thing. It can be used in that way. And it's a thing that the Firebase team has a product to help support, is this coding in real time thing through Firebase. So it's kind of an officially sanctioned cool way to use Firebase, and that's what CodePen uses internally to power collab mode and professor mode. Pretty cool. Another random thing, I don't want to go on forever, but CodePen is doing weekly challenges now. So if you go to codepen.io/challenges, you'll see, you know, what's happening that week. And it's just a prompt for you to level up and learn something and share that the whole community is building at once. So that's kind of cool. And we're having a conference in Chicago this summer, codepenworldsfair.com. Check out that. Talk to you later.
Andy Bell writes in, actually audio question. So here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dev. Something that continues to bother me is, what do we call modern JavaScript? I've been calling it ES6 for ages. But there's ES7, ES2015, ES2016, etc. Is it time to give it a sustainable long-term name? Maybe we just call it JavaScript. Cheers to the show. Ciao.
It is JavaScript, so I think it does already have that name. So if you wanted to just call it that, I don't think anybody's going to say that you're incorrect in a way. But certainly it does have code names. I mean, ES6 is kind of the winner at the moment, but it does represent something very specific. ES6 does have meaning. And I remember there was a little fight between should it be ES2015 or ES6. And I think I remember reading up a bunch on it and kind of thinking that ES2015 made sense because it was directly tied to the exact year on the specification of that year. And it seemed like, why have this shorthand for it that's one number incremented from that? And it seemed weird, but I think it's lost. I think ES6 kind of won that battle, but it still refers to, I believe, the ECMAScript 2015 spec or whatever, right? Doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe you're right. And yeah, I think it was just kind of this idea that we had the TC39 meetings in 2015 and this is what we came up with and agreed to. So we'll call it this. But I think the speed of implementation, some browsers are just now implementing ES2015 stuff in 2018. So it's like, what ES is it exactly? So I think the version numbers is kind of like easier to say, like we support this version. I think ES7, ES6 was a big package. ES5, I think, and ES6 were big packages. But ES7, right.
Destructuring and the arrow functions and the stuff that most of the really weird syntax stuff is what we consider ES6. So it's kind of like the CSS3 of JavaScript in a way. A lot of the big changes happen then. But still, they've committed to this. Every year, we're going to release a new edition of ECMAScript. And so there's ES2016 too, which maps to ES7, which is weird. Again, it's the one number off kind of thing.
Zero ordinal.
So it's like, can we just pick one of these things and go with it? I don't know if that will ever happen or what, but it seems to me that the ESX is kind of somewhat winning this battle a bit. And so ES7 refers to the ECMAScript version that was released in June 2016. ES8 is June 2017. So I guess technically we're on ES8. They're just those things are a little smaller in scope, I think. Like not as much stuff has happened in ES7 and 8. Certainly a bunch of stuff has. But anyway, so what's the deal? Like do you like these names or do you think they're stupid too or what?
I think it's a lot like CSS3. I mean, it's just kind of a big encompassing thing, and you're kind of like, oh, well, it's got all these features and HTML5. And I think we're on 5.2 now or something like that. Yeah. So it's like, I think it's just a version number, a big version number. So, I like the single numbers. The years is I could be convinced the years are great because it expresses when that was made and makes browsers feel late for implementing that stuff very late, but for me it's like just keep it simple.
Whichever one's more popular, I just want one to win. And what I like about it is that I think it's taking a cue from browsers, who most of which have said, come hell or high water, on this date, this version of this browser's dropping. Whatever's done is done. Whatever's done is going in it. We have a fast development cycle, and we release regularly and often, and I think it's cool to see specs doing the same thing. It's like, the spec evolves, some of the stuff is ready, some of the stuff is not. Whatever's done and ready goes in that version, out the door, so that there's not 5 years in between releases, that having a steady release schedule with promises, get it? Makes that stuff
happen. Hey, finally.
So naming then, each release seems fine. You call it JavaScript.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like your term, the new JavaScript, I think. But that's almost kind of gets into framework-y.
Modern JavaScript to me means like ES6 Plus, and new JavaScript means state machines, essentially.
State machines, web audio API, no. I think eventually it will just be called JavaScript. I mean, that's how we treat CSS. We're not big on CSS level 4, you know, or CSS 4, you know, we're not calling level 4 selectors CSS 4. So I think we just called it CSS, you know.
Indeed.
All right.
So Ben Robertson, I guess here, I know scroll jacking is typically frowned upon. Do you guys have any tips on doing it well from a progressive enhancement and accessibility perspective? Is there a less menacing sounding synonym for scroll jacking? I can tell you, somebody occasionally posts a website in which that there is some scroll-related anything attached to it. The first comment is always like, I hate it. I hate how it interferes with how my thing scrolls. So I don't know if there's an official term for scroll tracking. In my mind, there's about 20 things that can happen that slightly change or augment how a website scrolls. One of them being parallax. Dave even just recently wrote about cheap-ass parallax, in which it doesn't affect how the web page scrolls at all. It's just the things inside of it move at a rate that's slightly different than you would expect. It's not like one-to-one how it scrolls. Something might scroll a little faster than you expect it to or slower than you are used to, but it doesn't like change the scroll bar. It just changes what happens when you scroll. Is that scroll jacking? Would you call any of those parallax effects scroll jacking, Dave, or no?
You know, it depends, like the level of like the amount. Like if you're just kind of, for me, the cheap ass parallax thing, which is CSS, like I'm just using JavaScript to basically set a CSS custom property on scroll. Which has its performance problems, but sure, at the like frame rate level, you know, and you know, when you ask the browser for like, you know, window.scrollY or whatever it is, like it doesn't, it's not subpixel scrolling, you know, so like your math now is not true to exactly what's going on. So, and there's some frame rate stuff.
So you say scroll jacking means though, like I have hijacked the scrolling experience. So if you really did overdo parallax to some degree, maybe you are kind of hijacking.
Yeah, I think scroll jacking, you know, what was that one? It was very cool. So I'm not the Apple where you scroll, you know, and then like the device like exploded and, you know, you keep scrolling and then it zips back together and then it like goes to down to the next thing. Like
it seems to me that that experience, it had some of that parallax stuff in it, which it did, but it also had this like scroll locking kind of thing that you'd scroll to a particular point and it wouldn't let you be like 93% of the way there. It would just kind of take over and get you to 100% there. Like there was like panels or viewports that it wanted you to see, and being in between one of those was kind of unacceptable. It either take you to the previous one or to the front. That's what I think more of scroll jacking in my mind is, like when it, yeah, when it like forces you to a panel kind of thing, like scroll snap, yeah, points.
Like you do a half swipe and it just like, and like pulls you like halfway down the page, you know? Like,
sure. And there are scroll snap points. So there's a native version of this as well, but generally not thought of as scroll jacking because I guess if it's natively implemented, it works a little smoother or it doesn't affect performance, yeah, at least.
Yeah. Because like down to the millisecond level, there's some latency, right? Like it's almost like 100 milliseconds. Like when you tap the screen and when you can control it, like if you like tap the screen on your iPad and kind of move it around real quick. Like it's not going to be one-to-one with your finger, like exactly, you know? And so it'll kind of like very much like kind of trail just a little bit behind, but like the goal is to like make it look like your finger is manipulating the page exactly directly. So there's like a little bit of latency at the millisecond level. I think scroll jacking is when like, somebody's trying to scroll, whether with mouse wheel, Apple Mighty Magic Mouse, a glass trackpad, or on an iPad with their fingers or a Surface, like that the behavior, the scrolling is fluid and expected. That's what to me is
sure. Fluid violates, and expected. How about that? That's good.
Yeah. When it violates fluid and expected, that is a scroll jacking.
So that's why I don't mind that word exists, because it's like derogatory or something on purpose. It's kind of like a negative connotation, which is what Ben writes in here. Is like, is there a less menacing sounding name for it? Maybe there shouldn't be. Maybe we should use scroll jacking when we mean it, when we're mad about a website doing something very like heavy-handed with the scrolling experience. We'll call it scroll jacking. But if it's something that like I saw, I tweeted one the other day of like some iMacs that like kind of change their perspective when you scroll up and down. Now that might have accessibility considerations of somebody that like finds that very unsettling to watch or something, but it was fluid and expected to me. It didn't do anything so weird that it messed with the content or what you expect from scrolling up and down. It just had an interesting effect as you did it.
So, and there was I think even like Chrome team would, or any browser team, but like I hear the Chrome team talk about this a lot, is kind of getting into like maintaining 60 FPS. You know, even with just crappy JavaScript, you can lock the main thread to where when I hit scroll or I click an input and nothing kind of happens, or like, you know, it like takes a while to like focus the input or something like that. That's kind of a form of scroll jacking we call jank.
Yeah. Would you request like, animation frame it in order to avoid that? Because it doesn't seem like it could be a service or a web worker, right? Because it needs to affect the DOM and you don't get to do that in a web worker, right?
Yeah. It's basically you've just overloaded the CPU, you know? And so.
Yeah. You've called a function that says do this thing. And when you do that, it's like it needs to finish doing that thing before it can get onto any other thing, because it's a single threaded main thread situation. So. Yeah.
And so that's why parallax can fall into the scroll jacking, because you're doing so many things.
Like, yeah. And you can't, once. What are the two words called where you throttle or debounce or whatever? You kind of can't, because if it's janky, it's not worth doing at all. Right.
Right. Right. And so I think that's like sort of that's like a big kind of concern, I guess. It is like, you know, how do you not do it? There is like some progressive enhancement tips. It's not in every browser. It's just in iOS, but there's a prefers reduced motion media query. And that's also subject to change. Like it's in spec, it's WebKit mm-hmm. prefers reduced motion. But if you can say like at media, WebKit prefers reduced motion, reduce, you can basically just turn off transitions or disable, you know, animations or whatever you're trying to do. And that's why I like this cheap ass parallax sort of way to do it, because I can do that all in CSS pretty easily. I don't have to like do JavaScript to kind of determine that sort of stuff. So, I think that's something that whole spec is going to change. It's not in every browser. You're just caring about iOS and I guess technically Mac desktop, but that's something to consider too, is you can get their prefers reduced motion is the only way to get out of it. There's really not a progressive enhancement, because you can't do prefers reduced motion.
You can just kind of ask, like that's another possibility. Like on the original design of the CodePen World's Fair teaser site is just loaded with crazy animations on purpose, because it was part of our brand and style guide thing. And then we're like, you know what? This is like above and beyond. So you literally can't even see the site unless you answer a question. Is a little bit of insanity with animations okay with you? Like you can handle it? Or like, do you just know that you're the kind of person that just doesn't want to see that or deal with it? And you literally have to choose one or the other until you even can view the site at all. And it doesn't use any media queries. It doesn't use reduced motion or anything. It'd be cool if we could count on that, but it's because it's so early days for that. Just asking was the way to go there.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no like, oh, if they don't prefer it, like, because if you do like WebKit prefers reduced motion, no preference, every browser is going to say that's like, or basically evaluate that to false. So then no, because they're like, I don't have a WebKit prefers reduced motion, so that's false. So like no browsers will get like animations. That's what stinks right now, is like we're in a situation where you can't progressively enhance into it. You can't ask if this feature is, you know, if they prefer or if they don't care about motion. It's only exclusionary. You can only say like, okay, if they've explicitly said no on this WebKit device, then I can disable it. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Look at this CodePen World's Fair. It's so, very, very nice. Very,
Mark your calendars, folks. May 30th and 31st, and workshops on Friday, June 1st from, you know, Wes Boss and Rachel Andrew and Val Head and Sarah Drasner. You're going to want to hit up these workshops. They're going to be sweet.
And Dave Rupert will be there.
Dave Rupert.
I should be there, right? Can I say that? Okay.
Yeah, you're
going to be there. Spoiler, Dave Rupert will be there.
No, it's good. And so, yeah, it's the just the teaser site is up, which is what I'm talking about. If you're listening to that right now, hopefully not too long, the official website will be up. But I'll tell you what, just Shop Talk Show listeners, just if you're dying to make sure that you can come to World's Fair, which I hope some of you are, because I'm going to be there the whole time, totally engaged, hanging out with everybody. It's our first event ever at CodePen. I couldn't be more excited about it. Please come. And if you need, I have a system in which that you can buy a ticket early and I'll give you a discount on that ticket if you choose to do it. Cause of course we'd like to pre-sell some tickets. So Shop Talk Show listeners, you got to email me, chris@codepen.io, and I'll hook you up with that so that you can at least consider it or whatever, just cause the full website isn't done where you can buy the official ticket, but I'll hook you up personally if you email me and ask me.
Chicago, Chicago, my hometown, messing around.
That's right.
That's a Frankie ditty. Hey. Trevor Anderson writes in, with performance being the concern, what are best practices when it comes to where you're putting your CSS? When you're using frameworks, libraries like React, Vue, Polymer, etc., what should get inlined in various elements? Div, H1, etc., and versus what goes in the head or versus an external style sheet. Asking this because you opened up different example apps and the different frameworks. It seems like I'm seeing more inline CSS than ever before. Maybe I'm crazy and there is no difference from the days before JS took over everything. Either way, with this new age in web development we've entered, I feel like it hasn't been talked about enough.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, I would say that the site of all sites in the world, those that are using some kind of CSS and JavaScript is still like probably the vast minority, you know, despite it being talked about quite a bit. It brought up something quite interesting, though, and that's usually not part of the conversation is if you're using some kind of CSS and JavaScript, and maybe you still have some external CSS because you've decided you're going to do some global CSS. Do you take advantage of the cascade and stuff? Probably not terribly rare. And I would encourage still what you haven't solved there is the critical CSS thing. So does critical CSS even matter in a world when the components only show up once JavaScript is ran anyway? Is it kind of not a story? I don't know. It's just, we can talk about it more, but it's funny to think of three ways CSS might be applied. Some which is inlined in some fashion, some of it is in an external CSS file, and some of it's critical CSS, which might still have a story if you're talking about a server rendered app.
Yeah. I mean, and there's even, I'm going to apply a fourth heat. Are you ready?
Yep.
Link tags before each like section of your site. Like, wow, so you basically get like a waterfall progressive rendering all the way down. So, this is my thing. I don't think like it's really talked about like where you put your stuff, you know? I think React is tending towards kind of turning into this, more everything goes in the JavaScript, you know, in like your, gonna in that essentially inlines, you know, into style tags inline. I don't think Polymer, I don't know where Polymer's at here. It used to have style tags like with each component, like style blocks, but I don't know that is necessarily the case now that they've switched to ES6 modules. Vue has that single file component thing where your CSS is kind of broken up in its own block in the Vue file.
Yeah, how does that hit the DOM? Does it inline them?
Yeah, I think Shadow DOM-y, like it's just
is it contained. Really? It's no way is it Shadow DOM. I mean, it's Shadow DOM-y.
I think it's custom elements.
Really? With a little?
Maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before on the Shop Talk Show.
No, I don't know. I just don't know how it. I know what a single file component looks like in Vue, and I know that you can put the scoped attribute on the style block. But I don't actually understand how it hits the DOM then. Like, where does that style block go? Does it just get inlined as a literal style block with like weird scope style?
That's actually, now I'm ignorant. Now I don't know. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I still write things in external files, CSS style sheets. I that's what I prefer.
It does what it looks like. It does what CSS modules does. Like it makes, it turns where whatever class name you used into just data gibberish, you know?
Okay.
And then,
okay. So there's like a processing effect on the component that will, well, what would you say? Atomizes it or containerizes it.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Cool.
Yeah. Interesting. I keep meddling over whether that's whether I like that or not. I'll have to. I want to give an opinion now. I have to think about it. So,
okay.
But yeah, I don't know. I hear a lot less about critical CSS these days, but I think it's still super valuable. I have discovered though, through like rolling out HTTPS on my site, like inline styles are kind of a deal. Like it's a security vector problem, right? To allow inline styles. I think there was like recently-ish, like a how to like write a keylogger with just CSS, you know, and that had a, like a caveat that you were using a React-y pattern where you're echoing the value out as a value attribute or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know, like, that's what people are doing. That's what I just did on my latest React project. So it's like, but the idea that like, if you can somehow inject some CSS somewhere, then all of a sudden you have like a key logger that can log keys. That's really pretty intense. So like inline styles is sort of a security vector. So I'm really curious how these things and Shadow DOM and everything kind of are like, are they, because it was always like advertised, like, oh, you just write your CSS here, or like, oh, we inline CSS. But like, given that that's a security concern, what do you do? I don't know.
I don't know either. I love Shadow DOM, though. I hope that becomes a big story in the next couple of years. You know,
yeah.
That's just how we do stuff now. Cool. That would be great. You can kind of think of it as like a somewhat of a solution to iframes as well. If like, you know, iframes are notoriously for kind of sucking at performance, and if everything you think of that you are need to use iframes for could be shadow DOM'd instead, that's awesome.
Yeah, why do I have a Discus element on my site and not just, or Discus iframe?
You could,
not just a
you totally
element.
Could. You already can. An embedded tweet is shadow DOM'd.
Wow. Well, that makes sense because it like sizes to the size.
That's another,
like pushes
exactly. Content, pushes content. And you go, that's like my favorite thing about Shadow DOM instead of iframe. There is no iframe ability. That's like, can you just be as high as the crap inside of you? Although I shouldn't say that because that's how iOS works. You can't, you cannot affect the height of a iframe in iOS. It's just as tall as the content is. You can't force it narrower or taller. It's very bizarre.
Hmm.
It's the worst feature ever.
iOS.
Go off forever. Luke Brown writes in. Last one, right?
Yeah, we'll can wrap it up here because it's a short show. We got to get back to work. And maybe a midday nap after all that day. Chris.
Yeah, I finished my beer here. As a self-taught web designer, developer, this is Luke Brown. I have learned a lot from many talented developers over the years and who've given up their time and resources for free to teach others, yourself included. Now that I feel experienced enough, I'd love to give back to the community in the same way by writing blog posts. However, I find it really difficult to find the time and motivation to write because sadly, I don't enjoy it. As you both have lots of experience with writing, I wanted to ask, is this something that I could learn to enjoy after enough practice and determination, or should I look at some other ways to give back to the community as writing may not be for me?
Yeah, if you don't like it, don't do it. Don't feel the pressure. I think I've written since high school. Like my good friend Mike Rice and I, we ran a zine in high school called Wimp Killer, and it was the best. And we like sneak out to like Kinko's at 4 a.m. and scam copies and print out a zine. Like, so I've been doing dumb writing for a really long time, and But so I like it. That's why I do it. So don't feel like pressured that you have to.
I wonder if one of the moments that you begin to start writing is when you get some positive feedback from something that you have written. This is probably not natural to just immediately love writing without any feedback at all. You know, like maybe you're just snake bitten from writing reports on tigers as a kid and you just didn't care for it or whatever. But certainly I don't think I'm a natural writer nor particularly good at it, but I've gotten at least a little bit better over time because people read what I write and it's kind of addictive.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I would say is the motivation, like you want to give back to the community, like you're doing somebody a favor, like maybe you just do it for yourself. Like I find most of the posts I write are just like, oh, I did this thing. I kind of want to remember I did this thing.
Yeah.
I'm writing it down. Or like, I have these thoughts about these things. And they're kind of complex or something. You know, if you've read my blog, I'm not a great writer, but I mash together four or five things I've been thinking about into like one weird, like not nonsensical post, I feel like. But like that for me, it's just about thinking through something, like kind of, I hit a starting point and I think through something, and kind of try to come to an end point. And that's what blogging and writing is for me. So I think you think of it as a tool for yourself, maybe more than like a tool to give back, because if you put any kind of, I don't know, hope in that the community is going to be like, oh, thank you for blogging, that's amazing, they won't do that. Instead, they will comment on all your typos and how wrong you are. So like, set the expectation that this is something you're doing.
That's the worst thing ever. I'm so sorry that we have to say that. I think it was probably a good caveat to put in here because it probably will happen to you. You may consider blogging somewhere in which that there is no opportunity to do that early on, you know, like, screw them, you know. It's just that used to just not be that way at all. You could write a dumb blog post and you'd get people that like politely corrected you or fixed your stuff for you or something. It used to be just a lot happier. I don't know what happened. The world happened. I think I have my suspicion is that we're just so much bigger as a community that it doesn't have that cozy, tight-knit feeling like communities, really small communities of any type experience, you know, like there's just like a little tiny tabletop game and there's a very small community on it. It's probably super positive, but it blows up and the world starts playing it. The community just turns negative. I don't know if that's solvable or if that's a fair analysis at all. It just seems to me that way. The bigger of a community it is, it doesn't mean it's irredeemable, but it certainly means that you're going to have to police it a lot more and the tendency to get negative is so much higher.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to kind of like, yeah, it's unfortunately like going to happen. I wish like abuse was not a thing. I get really actually upset that like is the common like default stance is you're like, okay, I'm going to publish something like, and you have to like gird yourself, you know? But this is a little bit of a more positive spin that I've been, you know, those, like laws, like the, you know, I don't know, Dunning-Kruger effect or like laws and effects. And they're always kind of like associated with a person. They're called eponymous laws. Like they belong to somebody's name. And I've been collecting like 20, 30 of them, but, one of them, and I'm going to do a post here, but, one of them is Cunningham's law, which is the best way to get the right answer on the internet is not to ask a question, it's to post the wrong answer.
Yes.
This is a really interesting, just because, you know, if you post something on the internet and it's like slightly wrong in any way, hundreds of people will dozens of people, I guess should say, will tell you you're wrong and they'll give you the right answer. It will not be in a package that you enjoy, because or a tone that you enjoy, but they will attempt to give you the right answer, even if they know nothing about the subject. But what I'm realizing is it's never fun to like put yourself out there and get like chastised or told you're wrong or whatever, look like an idiot. But I've been kind of in this, I've heard about this thing called like growth mindset, you know, that was a big topic of Satya Nadella's book, Hit Refresh. But just this idea that like you can like, okay, I'm going to learn from this. I'm going to get better from this, like in all things. Like I'm blogging so that I get better at like expressing my ideas and thinking through things. And if people come back with feedback, I can actually get like, I'm going to not be like in a, like a, what is it? The opposite of a growth mindset, like static or like closed mindset, I guess. But like, I'm going to just like keep growing here from learning. And I think that's kind of crucial to like blogging. So I think anyway, so motivation, I don't, if you don't have the motivation, it probably is not your thing. You know, that's the thing too, but.
Can you join some kind of community somehow and contribute back by hitting people up with help when they need it? Is there some kind of official organization you can join that pairs you up with somebody? Can you take on an intern? Can you help write documentation for an open source project or something at work to make sure everybody's on the same page? There's a thousand things you can do. You know, yep. I recommend not telling people they're wrong on Twitter. That's probably like not the best
one. Not the best growth mindset. No, a lot of women I know have like volunteered at Girl Develop It, like local, like educational things like that. You know, you could like go to meetups and give talks, which is kind of, you know, if you don't like the writing, maybe you like giving talks or something like that. But the kind of trick there is, the more you give talks, the more you learn. You actually have to like write it out and like figure it all out beforehand. But you know, for the first couple, you can just kind of like, maybe that's the motivation, like the stage, doing the thing on the stage. You know, podcasting is another option.
There you go. You know, start a podcast.
You know, if you just like to run your mouth for like an hour, boy, do I have a solution for you. Anyway,
what was that? You brought up a group of white men is called a podcast. We need to stop that joke from being funny because it needs to not be not true anymore. Speaking of Girl Develop It, Sarah Chips, the creator, the original creator of Girl Develop It, will be speaking at the CodePen World's Fair along with Dave Rupert. If you'd like.
Hey, there you go. Go to her talk instead of mine. Mine's going to be like how to run a successful LLC with a butt on your CodePen profile.
Against all odds.
Against all odds. The Dave Rupert story. Oh, it's always a joy when clients find out about that one.
Hey. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
Why does his last name
check to?
Atron.
Yeah. Yep. No, that should be fun. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be so good.
All right.
It's coming. That's coming soon. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this and your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one. That's the people want to hire people like you. And go to CodePen World Fair because it's going to be rad. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Jobdocshow.com.